Well, my goodness, that was quite a week. And boy, did it end dramatically, setting us up for a lot more questions about what comes next for healthcare. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And for now, the GOP attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act are not going anywhere. So what does that mean for the future? Well, for that, we have our senior health reporter, Dan Gorenstein. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Dan, we across Marketplace have followed all the twists and turns of this debate. So right now, no repeal, no replace. The Affordable Care Act is still the law of the land. What is next for people who buy insurance on the individual market? And first, people who qualify for subsidies under the ACA.
Right. Well, so we've got to make it clear. If you're buying through the federal exchange, healthcare.gov, there are some changes. There's a shorter open enrollment period, 6 weeks now instead of 12. There's also a new penalty, potentially. If you owe back premiums, then you could end up having to pay as much as 3 months of back premiums if you drop your coverage and decide you want to get coverage again. And then we get into more sort of the theoretical. President Trump, in his budget proposal, suggested cutting things like outreach, marketing, the call center by as much as $300 million. What this means is it could become a nightmare for people to sign up, Lizzie. A glitchy website, hard to get a human being to answer your question. You know, the kind of just basically poison the experience for consumers.
Well, what about people who do not qualify for subsidies? Where are they in this?
Well, it's actually connected. You know, the more young and healthy people that are sort of chased away for whatever reason, the more premiums are going to go up. There are about 10 million people in the individual market who are buying insurance that don't qualify for the Obamacare subsidies. And so with prices going up, they could be like, you know, forget about this. I'm out and roll the dice. And we also know President Trump has been talking about, you know, maybe not really enforcing the individual mandate. So there'd be no downside other than obviously risking getting hit by the proverbial bus.
Right.
The one thing we can say sort of for both groups, whether you have the subsidies or you don't, is that the more prices go up, the more people are going to shop. And as you know, that can really interrupt the care that you need.
This may not be the end of the healthcare debate. Senator John McCain, who voted no, said it is time for Congress to do the hard work our citizens expect of us and deserve. So what could happen now?
Well, Senator Lamar Alexander has already said, this was even before the vote last week, he said that he wants to hold a hearing on how to stabilize the individual market. I saw a recent Politico report about bipartisan members in the House beginning to quietly work on some sort of solutions. And what's really needed here, Lizzie, is just more certainty for insurers. And what that means at the end of the day is more money. That could come in any sort of number of different ways without getting into the weeds of insurance policy. But they do need this stability. They need the predictability. And really, I think the question is going to come down to how much do Republicans want to pour money into Obamacare, something that they vowed to repeal for years and years, and now they can't repeal and sort of are stuck with it.
What do you do, Dan, if you are listening to this and live in a state where there are not a lot of provider options?
Well, I mean, there are lots of states, lots of rural states in America that are used to that, right? Lots of people are used to having just a couple of insurers. What it looks like right now is there are about 40 counties in the country that have no one willing to sell insurance to them. When we saw this sort of phenomenon happen under the Obama administration, the health care officials under Obama worked really hard to cajole insurers to do something. I don't know that the Trump administration is going to do that sort of thing. At the same time, a lot of these counties that don't have any options are red counties. These are red patches of the country. And you've got to think they're going to be calling their lawmakers. I think the pressure is going to be on Congress to take some sort of step here. And some people are putting out proposals like you need to have a kind of like let people sign up for Medicare or let people sign up for Medicaid if they don't have any options. I think what's great about your question is that it really shows we've moved as a country. There's now an expectation that people should have access to care. And I think that's going to really push people in new directions.
Marketplace's senior health reporter, Dan Gorenstein, thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Now it's time for our segment Long and Short, when we borrow some terms from the world of finance and apply them to the news. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. And this week, to give us their bets, we have Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer and Andy Euler. Hi, guys.
Hey, Lizzie.
Hey, Lizzie.
I think I want to start with you, Andy, and let's flip this around a little bit. Yep. I want to start with your short. Tell me what you're short.
I'm short on infrastructure spending. We just had another report from the UN that says the United States needs to spend a whole lot more than even the $1 trillion that the President Trump has said that he's going to spend on infrastructure. I guess I'm short on infrastructure spending because it doesn't seem like there's as much money as we need to be spending. And I guess you can, you know, I guess you can spend in chunks and you can rebuild bridges and you can do things like, you know, making sure railways are safe, things like that. But it just doesn't seem like the numbers are going to add up any way that we put it. I know that the president has talked about public-private partnerships and things like that, and getting, you know, investment in infrastructure if it makes sense. But then you're having to talk the public into paying for things that they normally use for free. I mean, you're talking about toll roads and things like that. I just think the argument is tough. And so I'm short on the idea that we're going to have enough money to spend on infrastructure that we need.
Well, I would just like to insert a little ray of sunshine here, folks. Yes, it is true that Congress is tied up in knots at the moment, and it has some big decisions to make this fall. But I think maybe next year they might get around to infrastructure, especially because both parties really want this. And it's popular with voters. So no, not this year, but maybe next year.
Maybe next year. All right, Nancy, then let's stay with you. Tell me what you're short.
I am short an interest rate hike in September. I don't think the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates in September, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
One word, inflation. Inflation is not cooperating. The Fed has a target rate for inflation of 2%, and last month, the Consumer Price Index was only 1.6%. Inflation is a lot lower than the Fed had expected. Earlier this year, the Fed hinted there would be 3 interest rate hikes this year. So far, we've had 2. A lot of people were expecting 1 in September, but I really don't think it's going to happen. Maybe December, but it depends on what inflation does.
All right, Nancy, you have got a long about the Fed as well. Man, the Fed is getting into your head. Tell me what your long.
It is. Okay, so I think the Federal Reserve is going to start selling off its balance sheet of bonds in October. And I'll tell you why. The Fed, you know, when you follow the Fed, you parse the statements they issue after every meeting, word by word. Janet Yellen has been hinting all year long that the Fed is going to start selling off bonds. Now, remember, the Fed bought up a whole bunch of bonds in something it called quantitative easing. It was a way to try to stimulate the economy after the financial crisis.
Did several rounds of it, sure.
Right.
Yes, a big old cash injection that has kept interest rates low. And basically what Janet Yellen has been saying several times this year is, look, the economy is getting strong enough, we can take this crutch away. So I think the Fed is going to, in September, the Fed is going to announce that it will start tapering off its balance sheet in October.
So let's steer this ship from American monetary policy to American manufacturing.
Sure.
Andy, I would like you to take us out on your long.
I am long on lasers. Now, let me explain. I'm long on lasers changing the way that we make apparel. Basically, the way that we make jeans. I was doing some reporting on denim manufacturing, and one of the people that I talked to was a local sort of small-time jean maker here in Los Angeles, and he told me that he gets all of his stonewashing and things like that done by laser now.
Huh.
And so I said, okay. And he took me to the factory where it happens. It's a Spanish laser company that they imported the machine. And it's crazy. I mean, you see the denim actually sort of go up in smoke. And then the end result is a pair of stonewashed jeans. And apparently, it takes about 10,000 gallons of water to make a pair of jeans. This is all of the washing that has to happen, all of the sort of wear that has to go into making your jeans look super cool. It takes about half of the amount of water if you use these lasers. And so I'm long on the idea of using less water to make jeans, using less water to make everything that we wear, because these lasers are doing the work for us. And it's also really super cool looking. I have a video of it that we can post on the site, but it's kind of awesome. This denim just goes up in smoke, and then you have your jeans that that a laser made.
I got to say that that does not sound like it's a big jobs booster. That sounds like it's more on the automation train.
It is very much sort of on the automation train. I was talking to the manufacturers there at the factory, and I said, that means that you're probably going to be eliminating some jobs. And they sort of nodded and smiled because it's saving them money on their bottom line, but it's also eliminating jobs. You're right. It's a robot doing the work.
Marketplace's Andy Euler and Nancy Marshall-Genzer, thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Marketplace, we love to do the numbers, and here on the weekend show, we use them to put the events of the week in context. So with that, here are producers Tony Wagner and Eliza Mills to bring us this week's news by the numbers. Hit it, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is...
$84 million.
That's how many dollars the U.S. military spends on erectile dysfunction meds like Viagra and Cialis.
It's 10 times more than the maximum cost of medical services for transgender troops, which the RAND Corporation puts at about $8.4 million.
The president announced a ban on trans people in the military on Twitter this past week, but the military says that until the White House officially changes the guidelines, trans people can continue to serve and will be treated with respect. $400 million.
Apple has sold at least that many iPods since it launched the line in 2001.
The company quietly discontinued the Nano and Shuffle models this week. Now all that's left is the iPod Touch, which is really just an iPhone without the phone.
MP3 players were mostly cannibalized by smartphones long ago, but still, there's something a little sad about such an iconic device fading away.
It's true, no joke. The first time I watched season 2 of The Office, it was on the iPod Nano's little 2-inch screen.
What an old-fashioned sentence. 14.8.
That's a percentage of Taco Bell customers who visit the fast food chain between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m., according to QSR magazine.
The late-night crowd is a big earner for Taco Bell, and the restaurant is hoping to capitalize by partnering with rideshare company Lyft.
Lyft is testing Taco Mode, which would allow riders to press a button that would direct their driver to the nearest Taco Bell drive-thru, but only from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m.
Drivers don't seem psyched about the prospect so far, but maybe minds will change once they start raking in the cleaning fees from all the Doritos Locos crumbs.
And vomit.
Recently, the New York Times ran a story called When Syria Came to Fresno, Refugees Test Limits of Outstretched Hand. While that California city was ready for refugees, another town close by was not, Turlock, California. Large numbers of Syrian refugees moved there to make the most of cheap rents, but Turlock wasn't prepared. So it got us here at Marketplace Weekend thinking about the cost of resettlement and how refugees go about rebuilding a financial life. To help us with the first question, we have Stephen Camerata. He's the director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies. I started by asking him to give us some of the numbers on refugees in the U.S.
So the total refugee population in the United States is probably somewhere between 2 and 2.5 million. That, in other words, that's the people we've let in officially as refugees over the last few decades, and they're still here. Now, recently, the refugee numbers fluctuate somewhere around, say, 75,000 a year, though they've been a little bit more in the latter years of the Obama administration after having dropped in the earlier years. But the big sending countries right now are Bhutan, Burma, Iraq, Somalia. These are the countries that are sending the most people, or we're admitting the most people from there, maybe the better way to say it.
Yeah. obviously, we're in this moment where the president's travel ban and refugee policy are, you know, encountering a lot of legal challenges. But that aside, what goes into figuring out where they go?
In terms of where they go, typically it's the refugee resettlement agencies, and there are a whole bunch of them, often associated with various Christian denominations, but it's across the board. There are secular organizations as well. And they're the ones who often ask and try to resettle people in certain communities. Although a lot of refugees end up in cities and so forth, there is an attempt to sort of spread them out across the United States. And often this means that they settle in smaller towns and cities that may have more difficulty absorbing folks with all these special needs. But the reason partly that's done is housing costs are typically so much less and general cost of living is less. So the idea is, well, we can put folks in and it won't be quite so costly, but then also it creates a lot of challenges sometimes for those communities.
Well, so let's dig into those cost questions. I mean, I was looking at your research, and there's a number that says it's about $65,000 per person from Syria. What's behind that?
Right. So a lot of that is welfare costs. It's always important to remember that immigrants, when they arrive, have immediate access to all welfare programs. But it also involves the cost that the State Department incurs when it's vetting people, transporting people, and also helping them with resettlement. And then there's the Office of Refugee Resettlement in the United States, which does things like put people in apartments, buys them clothes when they arrive, furniture. Remember, refugees often arrive with very little. So refugees need a lot of assistance typically when they arrive. So there's all these immediate costs that both the State Department and the Office of Refugee Resettlement incur. You know, that can be very substantial every year. But then in addition to that, there are all these programs that folks are allowed to use. The Office of Refugee Resettlement does try to assist local communities, and they do give them grants, and they do give local nonprofits grants, but it's usually not that much.
What kind of an impact can refugee resettlement have on a local economy?
Right. Well, on the one hand, you're adding more people. That may mean more consumers and maybe potentially more workers. But because of all the special needs of refugees, often children in school who are several years behind, even in their own country, children who've experienced trauma, individuals who've experienced, adults who've experienced trauma, they often have, they bear significant psychological scars. And that can present challenges to the mental health system. So in areas like education and mental health, there can be big issues. And this can be a real struggle for local communities that are not so big, where a significant number of refugees do get settled to deal with these challenges. Now, it is true that refugees, because they're eligible for all welfare programs, can get a lot of assistance from the federal government. But it's important to remember that for the Office of Refugee Resettlement, or what the State Department does for folks when they arrive, is pretty short term. So it falls to the local community or the state or the county to start providing services pretty quick. And so, again, that can really strain budgets. But it's always important to remember refugee resettlement is not supposed to be about a benefit to the United States, but rather it's supposed to be about a humanitarian policy that we're trying to rescue people who are more or less fleeing for their lives.
Stephen Camerata, Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
For the second part of our story, we turn to a couple in Los Angeles. A lot of life in the U.S. revolves around money and credit. So what happens when you have to leave your home and leave everything you know to rebuild your economic life?
My name is Jay Abdul. I am a Syrian actor. I had to flee my country in 2011.
My name is Fadia Fashe. I am a visual artist, activist for women's rights. I came before my husband. I came as a student to the U.S. and I was planning to study, finish, and go back home. Then when the situation in Syria went from bad to worse, I called my husband and asked him to come and visit me.
When I left Syria, I didn't think for a minute it will be forever. I didn't want to leave my country because I had a wonderful career, but I wasn't safe.
We decided there is no home anymore. And this is our country, and we are not going back.
Suddenly you are no one. You have to seek everything to start from scratch. I'm asking for help. I'm asking for financial help because I couldn't move any of my assets out of Syria because nobody could. All my savings were confiscated in Syria because I took stand by the people.
We lost our saving, our retirement plan, our houses, everything we built back home. Whenever you are asylee in the U.S., you don't have any help or support because you are not approved yet. After approval, you get help for just 8 months. I was looking at my husband, telling him we could be homeless and no one will come to us to ask us, do you need anything or any help? We needed someone just to tell us how to turn the heater on, to tell us like, oh, you need a credit history in order to get an apartment.
We kept applying for apartments, sending emails, and we were always rejected. And we didn't know why. We didn't know about the credit. We didn't know that they don't give apartments to jobless people. We started thinking it was personal just because we were Syrians. The system in Syria is totally different. We don't have the credit. We don't use credit cards. We deal only in cash. If you go to rent an apartment, you don't need any credit.
Actually, the only way we were able to get this apartment by paying 6 months in advance, but that was all our money. I think the resettlement program for the refugees are very limited. This assistant is just will never really cover your expenses for rent.
I think I applied for more than 300 jobs. And I didn't get an interview. I saw an ad saying that we're looking for drivers to deliver flowers. And they hired me. I was delivering flowers like 2 or 3 days a week, making $300 a month, which is nothing.
We hardly have money to eat. We ate bones for many, many weeks because we don't have enough money.
After all, I found Uber and Lyft, and I started driving for those companies. I made more money. Now that we have friends, we feel family. Yes, we don't have our family here, but we have a foster family.
I know many refugees, they would not have been survived without the help of other American people.
I'm so grateful and happy that my wife has a decent job. So we are financially safe, we are secured, we don't fear tomorrow, you know. We can pay our apartment, we can afford to lease a car and to have food on the table.
It's not easy to suddenly become a refugee. Ask anyone, no one would think in his life that he will be a refugee one day, including myself.
That was Fadia Afashe and Jay Abdo sharing their experience of rebuilding an economic life as refugees in the United States. That story was produced by Alyssa Dudley. Wall Street has long been criticized for having overwhelmingly white and male executives, and then promising to make diversity a priority. But it seems some big banks are failing to make good on their promises, especially for Black employees. Black senior executives make up no more than 2.6% of top positions at JPMorgan Chase, Citi, and Goldman Sachs. And the number of Black workers is actually falling in all U.S. positions at JPMorgan, Citi, and Bank of America, from 15.2% to 13.1%. Max Abelson wrote about this for Bloomberg Businessweek, and he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lizzie.
What is causing the number of Black executives on Wall Street to go down, especially among investment banks?
And especially considering the number of investment banks wasn't even good to begin with.
Yeah.
Racial diversity wasn't great on Wall Street, and now our numbers show they're getting worse. You know, it's a complicated question. Jordan Holman, my All-Star colleague, and I talked to a lot of Black bankers and executives and also the academics who study them. And they consistently talked about a couple of things. One is that Wall Street is either unwilling or unable to change. And remember, Wall Street used to be basically exclusively white until not all that long ago.
And male.
And male, a lot of white men.
Firms have made promises about this. Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan put it in his shareholders' letter, I believe both this year and last year, you mentioned in your story. Are those real promises? Are they sort of empty window dressing?
Well, it doesn't look great when you get sort of credit. So Jamie got a lot of attention and credit this year when he said, look, you know, we're really proud of our diversity except for one thing, black diversity, and we're going to get a lot better. And my colleague Jordan, I called her a star for a reason. She said to me when we were reporting this story, you know, I have a feeling he might have said those exact words like verbatim a year earlier. And we looked back at his shareholder letter and they are the same exact words. I think maybe one or two might be different. The banks have spent years touting their own diversity, talking about how many diversity awards they get. You know, they have pictures of smiling black people on their websites and they pledge how much diversity matters. And yet, you know, not only is diversity static at some of the banks, at some of these big Wall Street firms, the percentages of black bankers is going down.
Yeah, especially in that top rung.
Yeah, not only do we see the percentage of black employees going down in the U.S., which is the numbers we're talking about here, it's the U.S. workforce, we see it going down at the top of the bank. And you take something like Citigroup, they have had one black executive in each of the last 5 years. And their executive pool has gone from having like 23 people to having 63 people. So they find all these new executives. In their case, not one of them was a new black person.
What did the banks tell you when you asked them why this is happening?
You know, you have to give props to Citigroup in particular. They said, we are not happy with these numbers and we're working to make them better. But I have to tell you, a lot of the other banks either didn't send a comment or sent a comment that was sort of like, you know, pretty interchangeable, sort of the type of thing that a lot of institutions in corporate America would say. And, you know, we have to be honest with ourselves. Lizzie, you and I are journalists and, you know, I think it's only fair to acknowledge that journalism is pretty white too.
There are absolutely
not a lot of black journalists joining the ranks. And, you know, Hollywood and Silicon Valley, those are collected in what's called the information industry and their black diversity numbers look a lot like Wall Street's.
You have a quote from someone in your story who is at J.P. Morgan saying, without a representative number of black leaders to look up to, it's hard to imagine yourself occupying a meaningful position. How does any of this change if there aren't people at the upper echelons who people coming in can look up to or maybe can, you know, give a hand to people coming in?
That's from a wonderful and intelligent young man. He's 27, named Jared Johnson, I believe. And you know, it's pretty discouraging, I think, when you go to work and you don't see anyone who looks like you.
I should say he was at J.P. Morgan and he's gone.
That's it. That's right. And he's gone because he's going to the MIT Sloan School of Business. I mean, he's exactly the type of star that Wall Street wants. But, you know, I think that what Jared would say if he were here, I think, is that the banks need to do a way better job of bringing black people in more creatively into the workforce. He talked about how, you know, sort of in off-cycle hiring, like the middle of the year, the people who would come in were, you know, friends of executives, just the people everyone knows, which is on the other end, you know, it's natural and it sort of feels like human nature. So he said people need to get creative about that. And then you definitely have to be creative about keeping someone like Jared in the company and making him feel that he's cared for and that he's sponsored and that there's going to be a path forward. But, you know, if he looks at the top of the bank, no matter where you are on Wall Street right now, if you look up to your executive suite, you are not going to find a black person leading your bank.
Max Abelson, who wrote this story with Jordan Holman for Bloomberg Business Week, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Lizzie.
On the show last week, we talked about bottled water versus tap. And of course, many of you had thoughts to share. On Facebook, Russ Sharples said, I don't know why this is such a mystery to people. It's not the water, it's the convenience of the bottle. It's clean, it's cold, and you didn't have to bring it from home or take it back home. Sarah Chasse had a different take. She said, I filter my bad-tasting tap water with a Brita pitcher. I drink from a reusable bottle at work and elsewhere away from home. Baffled by people who buy cases of bottled water, unless you live in Flint. Share your stories on anything you hear on the show. You can email us. We're weekend@marketplace.org. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Marketplace, WKND. Or subscribe to our newsletter. Just go to marketplace.org. You've been out for drinks or dinner with a friend lately?
how did you deal with the check? Maybe you used a payment app like Venmo. The company processed $17.6 billion in mobile payments last year. It's convenient, super popular with millennials, but some people worry that the convenience of it makes us nickel and dime our own friends. Here's elementary school teacher Margaret Penoyer.
I was riding the subway with a friend, and she realized she didn't have enough money on her Metro card, so I said, oh, let me swipe you through. And the next day, she said, oh, I Venmoed you the exact amount of money for the subway ride. And I think that's sort of the difference now, is that it's no longer just a part of friendship. I wanted to swipe her through. I didn't need the exact money. But now it's so easy to pay people back down to the penny. So I think people's friendships are becoming more transactional because it's so easy.
Penoyer shared her experience with Teddy Wayne, a columnist for The New York Times. Wayne started asking around and found a bunch of other people who are not thrilled with the effect Venmo has had on their social lives. His newest column is titled, Thanks to Venmo, We Now All Know How Cheap Our Friends Are. So, Teddy, does Venmo or the public nature of those transactions just scratch this part of us that's uncomfortable talking about money?
Absolutely. I think it's also part of a broader feeling that we're all being monetized in some way, even though this is individual to individual transactions, that you can be reduced to a precise data point. And this experience of a weekend bachelorette party is worth $31.98 instead of, let's just call it $30 and remember the experience rather than the price tag.
Is that all bad, though? I mean, Americans are sort of notoriously financially illiterate. Maybe it's good to know exactly what that round of drinks cost, particularly if maybe you don't have the, you know, clearest memory of it the next day.
I think when there are discrepancies of income or wealth, discrepancies of a bill, it makes sense. It's no one should be forced to pay twice what they owe to someone else who has maybe twice the money they have. When it's something like a cup of coffee that someone gets you, you probably would never, I don't know about you personally, but no one would ask their colleague who ran out to get a coffee for them to pay them back the $2.
Or go leave the studio right now. Go buy me a cup of coffee.
It's Starbucks. It'll cost them more. But I think with Venmo, that $2.50 bill seems a little bit more, a little easier to swallow because you're not handing over cash.
You also wrote about the social network nature of Venmo. I mean, one of the things that fascinates me about it is scrolling through my Venmo feed and seeing what people are paying each other for. And half the time they're, you know, paying for really mundane things like rent or, you know, groceries. But then half the time it's like some random string of emojis that I couldn't even begin to decipher.
Right. So there's a memo function to each Venmo transaction where you must record theoretically what it's for. On top of that, the default setting is to have your transactions be public, which a lot of people don't even know. So they're not even aware that their transactions are made legible to others. The dollar amount is not, but the transaction to whom it is and what it is are made viewable. So I think because of this, many memos are whimsically annotated, especially among young users.
Yeah.
I believe to mitigate the anxiety of the fact that you've just had a sort of formal invoice with a friend, and instead of calling it drinks that we had last night, where it seems like a receipt you're doing for tax purposes, they'll write a couple of emojis of beer or something like that. On top of that, there's, I think, this sense of curating one's lifestyle that applies to all social media, where they want people want to know, or they want others to know, they've been out having fun, and here's proof of it, and I spent money doing this fun.
Did you talk to anyone who charted the maybe birth and death of a relationship via Venmo?
I did speak to someone who mentioned that among his peer group, the early 20s, mid-20s, you can often do some detective work and see who is having sexual relationship with someone else via, you know, Uber payments or breakfast payments, things like that.
Wow, we've really become extremely receipts-oriented.
Yeah. Worse, though, is that a lot of people, I think, foolishly discuss sort of more illicit transactions or just hedonistic ones. And there's actually a website called Vicemo that has a running tally, I think probably through a search database of terms or emojis, of people who have paid for things involving drugs, sex, or alcohol.
Although I've looked at some of those and I kind of feel like the ones that say drugs,
yes,
drugs, and more drugs, they may be not entirely telling the truth.
Those ones, I think, are youthful jocularity, but for many of them, still there's evidence of you're kind of a partier, and you can, any employer could search a person's full name and find their transactions, and this is the sort of thing that, along with, say, revealing photos on Facebook or something, might get someone fired or not hired in the first place.
Did you talk to anybody who made their settings private because of all of this?
I certainly did. Once I looked into it, I didn't realize mine were public, I think, and I quickly changed it. I'm of the age where I'd want nothing like that to be public and don't care if people know or don't know that I went to dinner last night. I think people who read the article also hadn't realized their settings were made public. On top of that, the app also can scrub your phone contacts to add Venmo friends and might do it automatically without your knowledge. So, or add new people as they come onto the network. So there are a lot of things the app does without your knowledge that, you know, if you're at all privacy-oriented, meaning if you're probably born before a certain year, early 1980s, you'd most likely do well to look it into.
Teddy Wayne from The New York Times, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you spend too much settling Venmo bills, well, maybe you're in the mood for a discount. And I am not talking about scouring the Sunday paper for deals or hunting down coupons. No. Writer Lisa Ryan took it one step further when she realized just how many discounts are aimed at brides-to-be. So she decided to cash in, even though she's happily single, by faking an engagement. And she wrote about it for New York Magazine's The Cut, where she is a staff writer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
How did you first get this idea?
Well, I have been living in New York for 7.5 years, and my biggest vice is that I love fancy exercise classes. I could easily go to the gym, but I don't like to do it. I like someone telling me what to do and encouraging me, because otherwise I will just walk very slowly on the treadmill watching the Kardashians. So I have been going from exercise studio to exercise studio, trying out their introductory one-month package rates, but I've done that in so many places, and I was just like, I don't know what to do next. Like, do I bite the bullet and pay for something I can't afford, or do I join a gym? And then I saw the bridal discounts, and I was like, I could do that.
You saw a poster and thought, oh, hey.
Well, I've been seeing it online, and I was like, I wonder if anyone's ever pretended to be engaged. And then I was like, no, no one would ever do that, but I will.
So what did you do?
First, I bought a ring. I don't know anything about weddings or engagements at all, so I had somebody who knows a lot about fashion pick out a ring for me and explain to me that it was a fake 1-carat solitaire cut. And she's like, you need to know that when people ask about your ring. I was like, what? And then I made a wedding page because I have written about being single and dating just the past few months. And so I was like, if anyone Googles me, they're going to see I went to a breakup retreat in February and I'm clearly not engaged. So I made a page on The Knot, and then I emailed the place that I decided on, and I just said, hey, I'm getting married and I'm interested in your engagement package. And the next day I was in the studio.
Roughly how much of a discount are we talking about here?
It was about $90 off. It was kind of a random package rate, but I did the math on my phone calculator and I saw it was like $90 off a month. And so even though I paid $15 for an engagement ring, it's still a lot of money that I saved.
Yeah. What would the class normally be?
Usually I think it's between like $250 and like $350 for a month of unlimited.
But $90 off, that makes a pretty big difference.
Yeah, I was like, I will fake an engagement for this.
Did you have any moral qualms about doing this?
I did. I actually didn't think it would work. I was very surprised. And every time someone would ask me about my engagement, I felt like I was getting interrogated. And I was like, oh, no, they're going to know. Like, I felt a little bit weird faking an engagement for a discount. But at the same time, I have friends who are my age who still use their college IDs to get discounts at the movie theaters. You know, it's kind of on par with that.
After the fitness stuff, it sounds like a whole world of sort of discount doors opened to you.
Yeah. At first, I was only going to do it for the exercise classes, but I was really interested in seeing what else was out there. I noticed that people were a little bit nicer. Small talk was easier, and I got these discounts, and I got to wear like this beautiful fake ring everywhere. So I wanted to see what else I could get. So basically everything I know about weddings is from TV and movies. So I was like, I can go to a bakery and get tastings, and I can go wedding dress shopping and get drunk for free, and I could go to spas and get discounts. But of that, the only thing I followed through with was the wedding dress shopping.
And how was it?
It was the most bizarre experience of my life. I felt like an imposter, but at the same time, it was really interesting to see like the level of customer service that you get when you're willing to drop like $5,000 on a dress. I had an injured ankle, and they helped me limp around the store. They picked out beautiful dresses. They asked me what I was interested in, and they found the right thing for me, and I've never had anything like that at a store.
Yeah, what did you come away from all of this thinking? You know, if you meet someone, fall in love, get married, does it make you want to do this stuff, or does it make you want to run the other way?
It makes me want to run the other way. I liked being treated really nicely. I liked trying on fancy dresses that I could never afford. I liked getting discounted workout classes, and I liked wearing the pretty ring. But all the other details that I had to figure out to keep my story straight, it was just too much. Like having to think about the size of your wedding, catering, like it all seemed like a bit much. So I know that when the day comes, if it comes, I will be doing something very small and low key, and hopefully avoiding a lot of the stuff that I had planned out for my fake wedding.
Lisa Ryan, staff writer for New York Magazine's The Cut, thank you so much.
Thank you.
One thing we like to do here is ask people from the world of the arts, whether they're actors, writers, musicians, whatever, about their experiences with work and money, what shaped them, and what they've learned along the way.
Hi, my name is Devendra Banhart, and I'm on the Marketplace Quiz. Thanks for having me.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you.
It can lead to total dissatisfaction and the realization that money can't buy you happiness. I think you can live your whole life just trying to make more and more and more and more. But if you can create a little bit of space between that delusion that it's going to lead to happiness,
mm-hmm.
you can reach a moment where you go, oh, this really doesn't lead to happiness. So now I'm going to pursue what does.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, money does lead to happiness.
All right, you've proved us wrong. In a next life, what would your career be?
In the next life, what would my career be? Easy. Dried persimmon dealer. Now, if it was, that's if it's limited to a human life. If it's not, then I'll go with seaweed. I've always thought it'd be nice to be seaweed, kind of just floating about.
Wow.
Within that same kind of maritime theme, blue whale would be pretty fantastic.
When did you realize that being a musician could be an actual career?
When my family heard me sing my first song that I wrote when I was around 9, 10 years old in Caracas.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of those Sundays when we had dinner, we would have lunch, and lunch at my grandmother's house, and so the uncles are there, my cousins are there, my grandmother, and they were all sitting in the little living room, and I said, okay, I wrote a song, I'd like to present it. And I sang it to them, and it was the look of horror on their faces. It was the request to never do that again that made me think, ooh, okay, this might be something I want to pursue.
Do you remember the first time you got paid to perform?
The first paid show is in Los Angeles at an art opening, and I was paid maybe, I don't know, maybe $25.
Yeah.
But that pride, which was, that was a big deal,
mm-hmm.
but all of it was literally annihilated by the fact that while I was playing, I hear somebody yell, like, shut the F up, really loud. Oh, it kind of shocked me. I started crying. I mean, I was really
bummed
out because the person kept doing it, of course. And but then the show was over, and I felt like, okay, now I know what that's like. And it turns out that my friend Anti had paid this guy to do that, and he filmed it.
That's really cruel.
And At first, that's what I thought, too. Later on, I was so grateful because I kind of, you know, got to experience that. And yet, I also had the kind of ego padding of knowing that, well, they didn't really mean it. My friend paid them, you know what I mean? So it was kind of a strange gift.
What was your first job?
My first job was shoveling in a farm in El Junquito. So it's kind of farmlands of Venezuela, and there was a farm that my mom was friends with, the farm woman. She thought it'd be good for me to spend the summer there working on the farm. But my first paid job was bagging groceries at a market called Westward Ho. Doesn't exist anymore in California.
What is something everyone should own, no matter the cost?
Three things come to mind.
Okay.
A Nobel Peace Prize, chapstick, and universal compassion.
Some of those things are free.
Your chapstick, you mean, right?
Yeah, the chapstick's free, right? You can just take that from any CVS without paying.
If you're bagging groceries at Westford Hill, yeah.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started your career?
It's okay to not know. And it's okay to ask for help.
Do you feel like you did those things when you started out?
No. I feel like it was all about, no, I know. And I don't need anyone's help. I need to prove that I can be independent. But that isn't really how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And you definitely don't know everything. And not only that, but it's okay not to know everything.
Mm-hmm.
And asking for help doesn't suddenly make you intrinsically dependent or codependent. It's a dance.
That Marketplace quiz was produced by Haley Hirschman. And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Alyssa Dudley. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer, and Jake Gorski is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is our executive producer, and Deborah Clark is Marketplace's vice president and general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.